I don't say it mustn't be too serious, but it must be if you're going to do it, it's got to be a celebration of that seriousness, you know, and it's all good being, you know, this and we have this, and it's, that's brilliant, but it's got to lead down a joyful path, not like a serious. And what I invariably see is all the best support I get and all the best energy is from people who are new to the area, new to cider, or are young and coming up and just starting to drink, or are moving on in their drink experience to drinking other things. The old boys and the old people, they're open. Yeah. That's really, you've got to be open. So I would love to try and write a book that gave people an idea about the geography, but more the people, the characters, the people who make cider, who drink cider, the fun and the energy and like that thing that you can get by just sharing something, because from that comes everything else, the making, the need to make good cider, the need to make the best cider you can, and then the food that you'll have with it, and the restaurants and all that, and that's the important thing, you know, because we want more young people making cider. That's the only way it's going to survive, you know. Otherwise, we're done.
Ok, pomme, j'adore ça, donc ça fait du cidre.
Est-ce que c'est bon le cidre?
Oui.
Bouscule tes sens.
Mais bien sûr, monsieur, quand c'est permissible à l'apéro.
Que vous avez vu, bu deux, trois coups de cidre et puis une autre bouteille de poêle après, alors là, c'est la grande valse.
L'acidité. La quoi?
Et enfin, la station régionale de Rennes nous permet de ne pas oublier que si la France est le pays du vin, elle est aussi celui du cidre.
Bouscule tes sens.
I don't have many local
customers
for my cider. It's too expensive. We do have a little bit, but most of my customers are in the big cities, for sure. Or export, you know, that's where my customers tend to be.
They're looking from restaurants?
Yes, yeah, restaurants, bottle shops, a few pubs, you know. There's a lot of really good pubs, you know. Okay. With but yes, though, you know, you can go... This program last night is about these motorway services, two of them, either side of the M5.
Yeah.
And in less than 3 days, they'll have sold 100 cases.
Wow!
Wow!
Of Perry.
Yeah. Wow!
I mean, it's
awesome.
Yeah.
In three days, one on three.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it goes to show that what happens if you can just raise the profile and get it into people's heads a little bit, it really does. And you have to try and catch people when they're open-minded, when they're going to be receptive to what you say. Oh dear. Sorry, that's the past.
Oh, that's fine.
No. That's chilled and it's gorgeous, but there you go. I thought I got away with it. There you go. So this is what I really think of as typical Oliver's Herefordshire cider. We keeve it, and we're talking late season bittersweet apples, like Dabinet and Yarlington Mill. Very, very standard. And there's a reason why they're very standard apples. They're just brilliant cider apples, in my mind. Yarlington is softer side of the tannins. Dabinet a bit harder and more impactful tannins. But all of them have some real nice character. Yarlington's a bit more floral. Dabinet's a little bit more punchy. But they're good. So we keeve them. We aim to bottle this at a gravity of about 20. So quite sweet when it goes in the bottle. It'll drop 5 or 6 degrees in the bottle, down to about 14. So it's in the sort of high mediums in terms of sweetness, really. Mm. But it sort of needs it because we're working on the sweetness to counteract the tannins, which can be quite hard and brusque. And then the carbonation is really the acidity. There's not a huge amount of acidity from the apples. So the acidity comes from the bubbles and, yeah, and the carbonic acid in that. But it's got that lovely big creamy mouthfeel to it. And I think it gives it a nice lovely fullness in the mouth as well. And then, you know, aroma-wise, it's just, it's very spicy. It's very clovey.
Yeah.
Christmas plum pudding. I mean, I've smelt this. I've smelt this in Brittany. Good length.
And it's smooth tannins.
Yeah.
Are you working in barrel or not?
No, so those are all in plastic, actually, in IBCs. We do a lot in barrel as well, but this is all tank. So anything that gives the impression of wood,
yeah,
and everything, it's the apples. It's the tannins, well, the phenolics in the tannins, which I love. You know, it just shows the complexity of the whole. We'll do, I don't know, 5 or 6 batches a year like this, all with a similar flavour profile.
Yeah.
But all different because they're different batches of fruit. You start at some stage, you know, yeah, and then you make one and then you go make the next one. And then, so, because, you know, but they're all the same principle in the process. Keeping the juice, bottling with some sweetness, letting it finish in the bottle. It's one of those drinks that I'm very happy to say there is nothing in it other than apple juice, because it's had no sulfur, no yeast, no nutrient, no pasteurization, no filtration, no nothing. It's just as it is. So it's good. Good. It's a good drink for it. And we sell it at a keen price, I think. Not as cheap as sparkling cider is in France, but not the most expensive in the UK, but for sure. You know, I would say the barrier stroke issue, you know, locally, because everybody made cider, yeah, locally. The fact that some of them made very good cider,
so few,
and most of them made yeah, very bad cider, but they still don't think there's any value in it. There we go. That's one of the hurdles that we have still yet to really overcome, you know. We're getting there, I think, slowly. I think that no doubt that it is the same problem. And I think you can speak in America too, to a degree. Though they lost the history of cider making, they also lost the recognition of any value in the cider, if there was any in the first place. So they've got that need to persuade people that cider isn't just a sort of sweet drink, you know, made any old which way. So we're all facing a similar thing to impose ourselves, and we don't seem to have the kudos or the grape has. I mean, everybody just falls over when you mention, you know, when grapes are mentioned or wines. It's just, cider, apples. Oh, but it's not. And I've never understood why there's such a big difference between the respect for wine and what I would hope would be the equal amount of respect for cider.
Mm.
There should be. They're both great drinks. They're both made from fruit. They're both made in a similar way. They're both very tasty. They're both great with food in their own respective places. I would say, actually, cider is a happier drink. I find most people I, you know, see drinking cider and know who drinks cider, they're actually of a happier disposition, especially when they've been drinking cider. Whereas a lot of other drinks, people just go a bit morose and down. You know. So I think that's one of the beauties and charms of it, but also one of the problems. It is so simple. It is so easy to make. Everybody's got apples. Everybody. But as we all know, actually, really good cider is not that easy to make. Anyway, one of the pluses for cider is that lower alcohol. But of course, that's a negative in terms of the ability to be self-preserving.
Mm.
You know, a wine at 14% will keep much better than a cider at 6. But a well-made cider at 6 will keep as well as a wine. I know that. You've got to get the right balances right. So the history here is that we were until 1998 we were a hop farm growing hops, and I made cider at home, which is the other side of the farm. So when we stopped growing hops in 1998, this farm was surrounded by hop yards, and the main enterprises here are beef and sheep. All right. So when we took out the hop yards, we put grass in for feeding the cattle and the sheep. I didn't put any. I put a few orchards. Well, I say orchards. They're very small orchards in, but we haven't got huge amounts of fruit. I grow, if I'm lucky, about 10% of the fruit I use a year. 90% is grown elsewhere. I've either got one chap. My biggest supplier I've contracted to for certain orchards that he has, so that's a secure supply of fruit for the rest of my life, as it were. then we've got three other growers who we have all their fruit from their orchards, and they pick and bring to me. And then we've got maybe a dozen or so other people who we get, you know, whatever fruit they have every year. Years ago, I wanted to have all my own orchards, but as I'm in the middle of losing all my peri pears to fire blight at the moment, I am so relieved that I get my fruit from lots of different places, because if I relied on myself for my own pears, I'm going to have no pears in a few years' time, because I'll have no peri pear trees left. So. You know, it is a balance, and also what's become clear is that I'm not an orchardist. You know, we just stick trees in the ground and let them look after themselves. You know, that's what I do, because that's the fruit that I like from those sort of trees.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, anyone can do that, really. All you've got to do is able to afford to have the land and put the trees in, and then that's it. So that there's no particular skill attached to it, but I still think it's the fruit from those trees is so good. But what I've been able to do by having other people growing the fruit is we can concentrate on making cider here. And so over the years we were never a visitor center, but we were one of the few places open at one stage. I'm now stopping that. We open only 2 hours a week in the shop, and everybody comes in those 2 hours to buy their cider. You know, rather than being open all day, and so it works really well. So, because it's becoming clear, you know, we've got to preserve our time. We need as much time for making cider as possible. There's only three of us. I'm actually very glad now that we have got lots of people supplying us with fruit, because we've also not only spread the risk from, say, fire blight, but other diseases, and then the frost thing. The climate is starting to change so much more too, that you know, having different locations in the county, I mean, they're all in Herefordshire, you know, it's not the rest of the world, but it's all Herefordshire, but different parts of Herefordshire, it's spreading the risk. So ultimately, we can usually always end up with the right amount of fruit of the quality we want every year, which is not something that happens in when you rely on your own fruit, that's for sure. So that's a big plus. Total amount we make each year is about 100,000 litres. But that's everything. So that will be kegs, cans, bottles, and boxes.
And boxes also.
Yeah, bag and boxes. So that's about 100,000 litres. Probably bottle about 20 to 30,000 litres a year. Yeah, probably, actually 30, it must be 30. Because we do batches of 1,000 and 2,000 litres. Except the smaller ones, we do 5,000. Actually, so we must bottle lots more than that. 40,000 in glass, 40,000 in boxes, 10,000 in kegs and 10,000 in cans. Something like that. Okay. It is a rough... You reach different, obviously, different routes to market. There's places that will have bottles, and they might have cans, but there's lots of places that will have cans and never have bottles. Too high a price and too much space.
Okay.
So, you know, in a lot of these modern places, they've got no storage space. They've got a fridge or something. So they'll buy X cases of cans a week to keep them going, but they'll never carry a big stock. They literally want... They want to buy it as they sell it. Yeah. If you see, that's how. So, and it works. It works really well. People have gone into our cider just purely through the cans, which is very interesting, and they stick to the cans. So, different people in terms of retail and consumer wise, a little bit different too. Frequently younger. If I'm going to say, it sounds like the classic thing to say, but they are the more active ones. So they'll be the walkers, the hikers, the go away for the weekend every weekend, which a lot seem to do. You know, they go somewhere every weekend and they'll pack. They don't want to be packing one or two 750s, they really want to pack a dozen cans.
Yeah.
Because they can carry a dozen cans in the rucksack, on the train. We were one of the, well, still one of the only sort of real craft or low-volume cider makers doing cans. And they're not cheap. They're not as cheap as other cans. But they're still really reasonably priced, I think, for what you're getting. You know, we charge £3. They charge about £3.50 in pubs around here, and in London they charge £5.
£5,
yeah. And the bags are for the pubs?
Yes.
Yes.
Pubs and festivals.
Yeah.
Especially camera festivals. So I took 10 boxes over to Worcester this morning because they've got their big festival on over the weekend. They go on to a pump line.
Yeah.
So that's in the cellar, out of sight, so nobody sees the box or anything like that. Temperature's controlled, and they pull up a still product up. But quite often, if you put a sparkler on the tap handle, on the dispensing, put a sparkler on, it just pushes it through the sparkler, and it's not carbonation, no, but it gives a sense of some life in the cider, and that's all. And then we do kegs as well. So we do some keg conditioned ciders and perries, and we do one standard wild farmhouse keg of back sweetened carbonated cider, 5.8%, and it's pretty much the sort of thing that pubs want if they're going to have a farmhouse cider. That sort of fits the bill, and that's the only one we'll do. We won't get any more exotic than that. That'll do us, because we don't make much money on kegs. We have to get them contract packed elsewhere, so it does spread the name. If you've got some loyalty, either from the pub or from the drinkers, it keeps that loyalty going, which is important.
You are doing some collaboration also?
Yeah, lots of collaborations. In the UK, I don't actually collaborate with any other cider makers in the UK. I collaborate with a brewery.
Oh, yeah.
And he was at the salon, Johnny Mills. He was...
Johnny Mills.
Yeah, so him and me do a lot of collaborating. Cider-wise, I collaborate with Johan from Pomologic in Sweden. Did you meet him? So they were up yesterday. So I collaborate with him. I collaborate with a chap called Alex in Moscow from Rebel Cider in Moscow. He's a young guy. He worked here for a season. He's making great cider in Moscow. We've had some bottles here. It's really, I mean, it's commercially, it's commercially minded cider, but it's beautifully made.
Yeah.
He understands tannins and acidity and balance, which is really crucial. So this is a still cider.
Okay.
Of which, I guess as you probably learnt by now, a lot of people drink still cider in the UK. And this is my vintage cider. So it's fermented and matured in old Irish whiskey barrels, this one. And I've gone over to Irish whiskey from Scottish whiskey because they're affordable, more easily available, and they don't impact the cider as much as the sort of peaty, smoky ones do. I don't mind a bit of peat and smoke, but in terms of, we run about 120 barrels a year, so that's 30,000 litres in oak, and the smoke and the peat was getting too much overall. So we've swapped out a lot of the Irish barrel. Sorry, the Scottish ones.
Bought in
the Irish, and we like it. It gives the same depth of colour, but it's just a little more less impactful on the cider. So for me,
more elegance, maybe more.
Yeah, and you get more. You get much more sense of the depth of fruit and everything with this. This is my type of cider. I just love the chewy, drying, fruity, lovely barrel around the edge. It's a bit over 9%, so it's got quite a weight behind it, as it were. Yeah, it's clear that it has been in a barrel, a spirit barrel, or a whiskey one, and it's probably pretty clear it's not a Scotch whiskey barrel. But it's nice. So by that time, then it's less clear exactly what type of barrel it has been in, which is really good too, because it then throws you back onto the fruit and the cider rather than the barrel. Well, let's open something else, and shall we go and have a little walk round?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, the sunny is coming out.
Stop for a moment. So, this shed was where the hop picking machine was, so they would pick the hop binds in the field, bring them in here, and I don't know if you know a hop bind, but it's very, very long, 16 foot long. There's one in the hedge out there that's about 30 foot long. Yarrick does the pressing. There's the kit down there. It's all broken down at the moment. And we'll have to be reassembled fairly shortly because we're probably going to start in the middle of September.
Yeah.
It's only 4 weeks away. Just amazing. But there we go. So when it's all set up, all the fruit will arrive out there, and there's areas to tip trailers, or we use lots of crates too, apple bins that can go on and be tipped up like that. We use lots of those. And we start pressing about the middle of September, and we go on till beginning of December at the earliest. middle of December if it's been a tough year. So it's about 3 months. We don't aim to rather take it steady, not long days, do 7 hour days or something, but it's enough. Over 3 months it's enough. We get enough fruit pressed just about, and hopefully we do it without killing everybody, you know. It's just as I say, and so Yarick with the beard, he does all the pressing, and he's got that down to a T, and it's a one person job with our setup, which is brilliant. And there's no like really heavy lifting or anything, so that works well. I'm responsible for collecting the fruit, or not picking it so much now. I can't pick like I used to, so I try not to now. I try and find others, but still have to do my bit, I think. And because of our approach, the pressing is done as and when we think the fruit is ready to press. It usually means we store it out there for a week, okay, or 2 weeks, or two minutes if it's the pears at the beginning of the season, because
sure,
they're juicing themselves at that stage. And then towards the end of the season, some of those longer lasting bittersweets will last 2 weeks in the crates easily. So we do what we think is appropriate. We'll blend whatever fruit we can out there. I don't press many single varietals. I don't make many single varietals. Even if I say it's Yarlington Mill, it'll be Yarlington Mill with 5% Foxwell. Or if it's a Davinet, it'll be probably Davinet with 10% Foxwell. We sometimes might do Stoke Red on its own. We do a little bit of Yarlington on its own, and sometimes a bit of Davinet, but not huge amounts. So our approach is to blend the fruit as it comes in. So once it's fermented through, and we've got to the spring, we've got a cider of about 6.5% alcohol. It's got decent tannin level, and it's got good acidity, because I then consider that the cider should be able to keep itself. You know, the tannins being antimicrobial, antioxidative, we should have no trouble. So that's the aim, and the same would apply to the pears as well. Though with the nature of pears, sometimes we still do not many single varietals, if I'm honest. It's mostly blends. I'm a big believer in blending, so we blend at pressing, and then we blend in the spring when we package.
Okay.
The spring blending will be for a finished product,
rather
than for any other reason, and that will be a combination maybe of tank fermented fruit, plastic fermented fruit, and barrel fermented fruit, just depending on what we think works. We don't use any yeast, we don't use any sulfur, and it's spontaneous fermentation. It seems to suit us. It suits me. That's the way I've always imagined cider is. It is the way it always has been for us. I don't see any reason to change it yet. Our fermentations are far from funky or exotic or wild or awful. You know, they can be really, in my mind, really clean, you know. So I'm happy with that. My aim is at the end of pressing, middle of December, is to have every tank full. It'll be full of fermenting cider or cider from last year. We really don't look at it then until after we finish the lambing in the spring, which will be end of March, beginning of April. We'll then start looking at what we've got and going around tasting everything, and building up a picture of what we think we can make, you know, in the coming year.
Yeah.
And I don't do any analyzing or measuring or anything. It's fermenting, you know. If the airlocks are bubbling, and so my philosophy is, I have enough work to do already. I don't want to do anything that's not really going to be, you know, worthwhile.
Fermentation.
Yeah. It just seems no point in in opening up something to put something in to measure it, to close it up again, to lose the CO2 that you've got naturally in there or whatever. You know, I'm not a big messer. We can go and have a look at some barrels now, where the barrels are.
Yep.
Oh, this is Yarrick's phone. Where's it? Oh, it's down there. You've just received a call.
What just happened?
AC/DC just rang.
AC/DC?
Yeah.
You know, you've got time to pick it up, but if you want to listen to the music, just don't pick up, just listen to it.
Right, should we try a little bit of Perry? That's what I mean.
Oh.
Let's see. Well, the choice is very limited, I'm afraid.
Thanks for that.
Cheers.
Thanks.
Come on down and we'll just have a look in the barrel rooms then.
Sure.
Just mind the little step.
Yeah.
What we've done is taken, obviously we're just reusing the buildings as they were, and these were the kilns where we dried the hops. The hops would be up there on the floor and to a depth of a couple of feet like that, or a metre, not quite a metre, but coal initially, but then it was diesel burners pushing hot air in. And the fan would draw the hot air up to dry the hops. So we haven't used these kilns since then. So we just started using them because this one especially, it's quite cool and dry, despite the water trying to get in. We just found it a really good space for barrels. And we've got two rooms like this. That corridor and a lean-to out there. So between the whole four spaces, we can get about 120 barrels in. And as you can see, we're swapping barrels over. So we've got another 40 coming any day now. 6 ex-Madeira barrels and 32 more whiskey barrels from Ireland. And then we should be fairly close then to what we need. I mean, I like them being on their own, away from everything. Literally, you know, once we've filled these, put the airlock in and made sure they're fermenting, we'll leave them. You know, we won't come in here for 2 or 3 months. We might come in once a week to check all the airlocks, you know, clean and do that. But we won't be doing anything else, you know. And we won't be kicking them or touching them or rolling them or messing with them.
Making some music somewhere?
Yeah. we reckon they like it quiet. Nice and still. Still and silent, just to do their thing. For the most part, that's what they do. I actually, when I first started making cider, I only used barrels. I didn't use steel or plastic at all.
Okay.
For the first 4 or 5 years, just barrels. I love the shape is like a great shape. Fermentation, the way it goes, fermentation is quite vigorous, and the barrel lends itself to harnessing the vigor, you know, because it go up and down. Like that, so I think everything mixes as well. You activate all the yeast, all the nutrient, the sediment only starts dropping when the violent fermentation is finished. It all seems to make great sense to me if that's what happens.
And it wasn't a traditional culture of cider to use some barrel.
Or most farmhouse cider was in barrels. Some was in bigger barrels, like vats almost, you know, but most of the farms that I knew all had barrels. They didn't change their barrels, mind. So sometimes the barrels left a little bit to be desired, if I can say that. I think, you know, a barrel's good for 4 to 6 years if you keep it clean.
And how do you clean the barrel?
So, there's a... Our approach is, it's the organic matter we want out of the barrel. Mm. I don't want to sterilize it. There's no point. Who knows what's in the wood? You know, like that. So you'll never... Whatever anyone says, you might sterilize it for a while, but then something deep down will come out and it's no longer sterile. So we believe, get the organic matter out, because organic matter is what harbors, you know, bacteria and encourages the negative bacteria to flourish. Would you like to try a couple of sort of different things? New different things?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so this is my attempt at a more youthful drink. Oh. Bearing in mind how I think the youthful palate is at the moment, it seems to be able to take a bit more acid. Than I recall in my youth. So a bit more tangy, but trying to get enough fruit and everything in there. So it's basically 60% Kieve cider, blended Kieve cider, and 40% Foxwell. So you get that acid and tang from the Foxwell. You get the fruit, obviously, and the apple from the Kieve cider, and then it's conditioned in the bottle, so you get some fizz as well and everything.
Yeah.
It's quite fresh, vibrant, sherbety.
I love this one. I love Foxwell. It's my favourite one.
I mean, it's the Hereford acid apple. Though the apple is actually from Gloucestershire.
Yeah.
But it's Herefordshire cider makers who've used it for, I don't know, about 100 years. All the old boys that I knew always used Foxwell in there. My concern is that moving away with the higher acid, there's also been a move away from tannin. And I don't think that's particularly, in my case, I think a very good thing, obviously, because my whole way of thinking is rooted in tannin for the balance. You know, the tannins, acids, sugars, it's all about that. But the way commercial cider is being made, and I should rephrase that, the way more widely distributed cider is made has definitely lowered the tannins, up the acid, and also, obviously, if you're upping the acid, you've got to up the sweetness as well. So you end up in I don't know, wherever you end up.
Yeah.
So what's happening is the ability of people to be able to instantly enjoy a tannic cider is getting reduced over time because they have no experience of it, you know. Whereas 100 years ago, people would have grown up, if you drank a cider, it would have been a tannic cider. Tannin, astringency, bitterness would have been all part of something you would expect. Now that's not the case. You couple that with the fact that most cider is being made with rejected culinary and eating apples, then you've got no tannin there anyway. So, and all they're doing is then putting fruit in, or fruits, or some form of fruit flavouring or something, you know, to make it. So it's not really forwarding anything. It's not, you know, it's not even a co-ferment or anything interesting. It's just, so I think the combination of things means that, acid up, tannin down, sweetness up, and character removed, so that, you know, the blander the cider. You know, when they do taste tests, you know, the question always is not can you actually taste anything. It's you know, it's make it as tasteless as possible, so that there's nothing there to challenge anyone, or upset them, or make them think about it. You know, they just want something that goes. So, I'm going to say this is my version of that type of drink, but with a little more, hopefully, a little more interest to it.
Well, a little bit experience. I know.
Yeah, I mean, I do find it quite interesting how close you play it to give people what they think they want, but also in I'm in clear in my mind what they actually need for them to stay long term cider drinkers and to let cider develop with them. You need to give them something that shows them that this drink is just not something you should ignore, but it's something you could actually over time really get to understand and enjoy. And hopefully, hopefully the lifetime devotion to a particular drink is something that cider should offer you spectacular returns. You know, it's like finding an artist or a visual artist or a music artist or a writer that you like, and they've got like 300 books they've written, and you just are so excited by the idea of following them, how they've developed over time or anything. The idea that they've written 300 books that just say the same old thing, I mean, wouldn't excite you at all. But cider's much, I just feel if you can see it in that positive light and portray it to people in that positive light, it should excite them, because they should think, great, I found this one cider I like, but there's literally hundreds out there. Well, God, this is an exciting journey.
Thank you. Did you write some book?
No, I've never. I mean, I'd love to. I love the idea, but I struggle with time. But that's everyone's excuse. I haven't got there yet. I keep trying to think of, because I don't want to write a.
Yeah.
I don't want to write a how to make cider book, because what does it,
Yeah.
Everybody. Yeah. And I don't want to write a book about, everybody's different cider around the world, because one of the things that I think is so important is that you need to make your own cider journey. So I want people to travel and not know anything and find out for themselves, because much like I did. There was nothing written, there was no internet, there was nothing. So you would travel to places not knowing anyone, and you would try and find out people, and you go to people and you go and say, hello. I make cider. Oh, what's that? In your at a cidery, and it's just like, I mean, I've had some great experiences. My favorite, I've got to share this with you. So I was at, this was at Hervé's, at Manoir de Quinquez. Lovely. So we go there, and it's a Saturday morning, and his wife, was there, and we were getting what I call the tourist version of everything. But I was trying to impress her that I we'd like to dig a little bit more below the surface, please, So at some stage, Hervé, if I'm pronouncing his name right, heard our conversation. Yeah. He came over and he said, "Oh, so you know a bit about cider?" I said, "Well, a few of us." Two of us make a bit of cider, and the third one drinks a lot of cider. Okay. And he said, "And who are you?" I said, "Well," and there was the Pete Brown and Bill Bradshaw big book, World of Cider, there with it open at his page. And I said, "Well, I'm in there as well. Where do you make cider?" I said, "England." He said, "They make cider in England?" And I honestly thought he was like, pull in my leg, but part of me thought, I don't think he is. I don't think he thinks He obviously knows that you make Strongbow in England, yeah. But I don't think he realised that there were other people making cider of the qualities that he would be making in England.
Oh, really?
So I had to open the book and show him the page.
To prove.
And I said, I seem to have got quite a few pages in here, because I knew I got more pages than him in there. But what I love is that thing about discovering stuff and meeting new people, and it is part of that energy. I would love to try and write a book that gave people an idea about the geography, but more the people, the characters, the people who make cider, who drink cider, the fun and the energy and like that thing that you can get by just sharing something, because from that comes everything else. The making, the need to make good cider, the need to make the best cider you can, and then the food that you'll have with it, and the restaurants and all that, and that's the important thing, you know, because we want more young people making cider. That's the only way it's going to survive, you know. Otherwise,
we're done.
And one of the great things about the salon, and when Martin and me started it, we had two main driving things behind it. One was we wanted to have more cider on sale in Bristol, which I think we've managed to do. Not hugely, but we have. And the other was to have more young people making cider.
Yeah.
And that was really clear
by the
number of people there, which was fantastic, making cider. So. And that's because none of it makes any sense unless there's a next generation. The orchards and everything, they need another generation. Mm. They need, and that. So that's the exciting thing. And I am chuffed to bits to see people trying it. And I'm also, I think, really pleased that I think, you know, there's more of an opportunity to survive financially now than there was when I started selling just 20, 25 years ago, when it was really tough. Now it's definitely, there's more opportunity now. There's people selling, there's one cider merchant, and there's two or three cider, four or five actually, cider distributors now.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. You know, it's a start.
Enough, I think so.
Right, one more thing.
Sure.
Hop cider infused with hops. Okay,
makes sense.
Yeah,
makes sense.
So this is exactly it. If anyone's going to make it, it's going to be me.
Thanks.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
So they are English hops. They're hops that are under development at the moment, so they're not readily available to brewers to use yet.
Okay.
But they've been used in some developmental blends, developmental beers in Herefordshire, and I'm not going for like the, you know, the tropical sort of IPA notes and so forth. That's not what I'm doing. Yeah. I'm looking for the more earthy, skunky, damp, dank, sort of bittering UK hop things on the nose. But once again, I'm trying to make a balanced drink. Get some nice. Just the right amount of sweetness there, some nice acidity, and then the hop and the tannin come together in a real nice, juicy. I think it's two or three years since we made our last one. This is the 11th one we've made, whether it's a hop cider or a hop perry.
Okay.
And it's been two or three years. For some reason, through COVID, we didn't make one. So we've just made it. So literally, we've just done a 1,000 bottles of this. But it would definitely be something we would think in terms of the possibilities in Key Keg or whatever. I'm not 100% sure if I can predict how the hopping lasts in an environment like a Key Keg, because I think the deterioration is much more close to a cask ale than it is to a long-term, stable, preserved keg. So my concern is that it's something, when we make cider, we like to make a big batch and then sell it over time. I think with this, I wouldn't want to make a huge batch of kegs and sell them over 4 or 5 months, because I think by the end of that, they're going to be getting a bit. I think they'd be great for the first 4 weeks or two months. So it would need to be treated very differently to the rest of the cider category. It need to be treated like cask beer.
Maybe one last question for you. If you have an advice to a young cider maker, what would be?
So I think there's two things. One is really, really make sure that you know what it is you're doing. That you can assess things. If your palate is not good enough, then you'll have to resort to science and measuring and everything like that. But really, you want the best palate you can, and then the best imagination to make the best use of that palate for when it comes to blending drinks, interpreting drinks, and understanding what's happening in the world of drinks. You know, if you want to pander to the young, then you need to know what the sort of drinks that young people will be drinking. If you want to make what you think is the classiest cider in the world, then you really need to know what's required of it, you know. So the second thing is be really good at spreadsheets and make sure that you're making money. Make sure you're not losing money, because it's so easy to get carried away and then, a lot of small cider makers are great, but you know, they're not relying, say, on the cider to make money, because they've got other incomes and stuff like that. Yes, and I do have other incomes. I have a farm and all that, but the whole thing has to make money. It can't be an indulgence, unless you can afford the indulgence, but not many people can. If you have a great palate and you have a good use of the spreadsheet, it gets really exciting, because you start finding out what really works, and then that thing gets really exciting, because you then know, you know where to aim for, or where to drive for, what are the areas that are good and useful to the to your business, and the areas that are like not so useful. And you know, I may want to make a lot of something, but if that's not worth it, then don't concentrate on what is. I find that whole thing exciting, and as we've gone along, we've done lots of things that people have said don't do. That thing, that sweet spot where your palate and your creativity, you're getting a bit more confident, and then you align it with a spreadsheet and you see where your things are going, and you start finding out where your business is best going to flourish. And I think that's quite exciting. And you know, no one's ever going to get like majorly rich, I don't think, but everyone should get well remunerated, because everyone will work very, very hard making cider. It's not a walk in the park, you know, is it? So but yeah, and there is a third thing: never ever stop enjoying it. Because if you stop enjoying it, then it becomes a trudge and a job, and it's just never worth it. But yeah, so there's three things, sorry. Don't stop enjoying it, it's the third thing.
Thank you, Tom.
Ok, pomme, j'adore ça, donc ça fait du cidre.
Est-ce que c'est bon le cidre?
Oui.
Bouscule des sens.
Mais bien sûr, monsieur, quand c'est permis, c'est pas l'apéro.
Vous avez vu, bu. 2-3 coups de cidre et puis un choc bouteille de poêle après, alors là c'est la grande valse.
L'acidité. La quoi?
Et enfin, la station régionale de Rennes nous permet de ne pas oublier que si la France est le pays du vin, elle est aussi celui du cidre.
Bouscule des sens.